Welcome to Surrounding Focus on The Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, coming to you live from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and Sudan on this Thursday, September 5th, 2024. Sudan's national soccer team beats Niger 1-0 in the African Cup of Nations qualifying match. And a non-profit Light for the World trains people with disabilities in South Sudan on how to survive during floods.
We are really face a lot of challenges on these flooding issues. For example, I use a motorbike and this motor rolling could not move through the water.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Some people living with disabilities in South Sudan's jungle estate say they suffer during flood seasons. A state government official says a lack of funds is to blame for slow response to help flood victims in the area. Weather experts are warning that floods are expected in September because of high water volumes at Lake Victoria. For VOA News, Dennis Longonyi reports from Bor.
As one approaches Bor town, stagnant water is obvious throughout Jongle Estate, as the area remains a hotspot for floods, which spare no one, including persons living with disabilities, who struggle more than others. The non-profit Light for the World is training 19 people living with disabilities, including government officials, on climate adaptation measures. Amer Mabut Ajith, who has a physical disability, says despite having a tricycle to reach out to persons with disabilities, she still finds it tough to move across Bor town.
We are really face a lot of challenges on these flooding issues. For example, I use a motorbike and this motor rolling could not move through the water. And also to my colleague whom I visit them and train them to know the right as a people living with disability in our village, Hanyidi, they are more suffering because they cannot move. They cannot go to where people are because of mobility device. Some of them are inside the house and flooding affecting them. Even others are dying now because of this flooding.
Once bitten, twice shy, Grace Kwekur says the warning from officials on expected floods brings back memories of last year this time.
My home now is flooding. A lot of water entering in my room. Everywhere, I cannot manage. If you have a relatives, some people, they carry you in that boat, and then they take you to where there is no flooding. But right now, we hear the flood is coming even everywhere, so I don't know where we are going to.
Philip Mabior, a resident of Bor town, says persons with disabilities in Jongle Estate need help to overcome challenges during rainy seasons.
We want frequent radio talk show to be carried out so that people are aware about whatever is going on in the community. Because some of them, they light some device for communications, like telephones, but when through the radio, they can even hear from the neighbors. And sometimes also, we want them to be given assistance of and food item like a shelter plastic, because when they go to other safe areas, they become homeless.
Majok John works for the non-profit Light for the World. He says his group is not able to operate in all the county's villages because of funding challenges. John says his group is providing mobility devices, wheelchairs, tricycles, walking sticks, white canes and temporary shelters to people with disabilities.
The reason I'm making this training on climate adaptation is to make persons with disabilities actively participating in society without barriers. Light for the World is not only doing one thematic area. Light for the World in Bor currently is also empowering women with disabilities and also economically. They give them support to also be resilient when it is in the face of flooding, they become active.
Daniel Chuey Kwey, a county civil administrator in Bor, says the lack of funding is to blame for government's slow reaction to the needs of persons with disabilities.
The town mayor is now implementing the howlet of the water to the river, but the fund that has given by the Netherlands through the IOM is now over. So the government remains vulnerable. As per now, the present governor of Jongle Estate, who is deputy governor, they have now prepared, they make the task force, the flood management committee at a high level, and they are moving in the six counties in Jongle Estate that has been affected.
Light for the World says an estimated 1.2 million people with disabilities in South Sudan are often invisible when crisis hit. Meteorologists estimate more than 5.4 million people are expected to live in flood-affected areas across South Sudan. For VOA News, I'm Dennis Longonyi reporting from Bor, Jongle Estate.
From Jonglei State, we go to China, where African leaders are in Beijing this week for the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation. Some experts on the continent's relations with the Far Eastern economic giant expect African countries to lobby for more Chinese investment. But analysts say China is increasingly focused on opposing the West, especially the United States, and this is likely to influence Beijing's dealings with Africa. Darren Taylor reports from Johannesburg, South Africa.
Everything that happens at the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation meeting, some analysts say, should be viewed through the lens of competition over Africa's resources between the world's two biggest powers, China and the United States. Africa's vast deposits of minerals and metals are critical to the world's future. Coltan, for example, is essential to making cell phones and computers. Others, including manganese, nickel and lithium, are crucial for renewable energy technology. The U.S. government calls China's influence in Africa malign, saying Beijing is advancing its own narrow commercial and geopolitical interests and undermining democracy on the continent. China denies this, saying it's boosting development in Africa while at the same time profiting from more trade. David Monnier of the Center for Africa-China Studies in Johannesburg expects the gathering, known as FOCAC, to demonstrate Beijing's desire for Africa to be on its side in its battle against what China calls Western hegemony.
If you look at China's domestic, regional and global politics, you see major shifts. And I think those shifts will have a direct bearing on its relationship with Africa. The tensions between China, United States and the Western world has intensified. And Africa is also becoming that center of these geopolitics, political as well as economic.
Cobus van Staden of the China Global South Project says President Xi Jinping's foreign policy is largely focused on creating a multipolar alliance in which Africa features strongly. China, he says, wants this forum to oppose institutions such as the United Nations and World Bank, which it considers to be unfairly dominated by Western powers. China is already Africa's largest trading partner, with trade topping $250 billion last year, according to United Nations and Chinese customs data. Many African countries owe China billions of dollars for huge infrastructure projects. To repay the loans, they sometimes have to cut spending on public services such as healthcare. Li Honghui, a senior researcher at the German Institute of Development and Sustainability, says China's become very wary of criticism of its activities in Africa.
The Chinese side actually pushing towards more collaboration between China and African countries on experience sharing regarding poverty reduction. This is also how the Chinese side wants to share its model with the African side.
Li says China is softening its approach to Africa, while at the same time making sure its economic, political and security ties to the continent remain strong. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Still on China. China has pledged $50 billion US dollars for Africa's development over the next 3 years. China's President Xi Jinping made the announcement during the Forum on Africa-China Cooperation, which is expected to deliver new policies and cooperation agreements between Beijing and Africa. African leaders attending the three-day summit look for more Chinese investment, while Beijing seeks markets for its goods and Africa's natural resources. J. Peter Pham is a former U.S. Special Envoy for the Great Lakes and Sahel region. He tells James Batty the United States should always be concerned whenever a competitor like China makes inroads anywhere in the world.
It certainly comes at an interesting time when increasingly we see even more competition between China and some of Africa's traditional partners in Europe and certainly the United States. And so what will be interesting is how China reacts to not only the competition, but also the fact that over the last decade, there's been a decline in after many years of increasing Chinese investment, there's actually been a decline, although it was a modest increase from the year before. Last year, the level of Chinese lending to Africa is half of what was a decade ago. And that's, you know, without counting inflation into the equation.
So in terms of, as you said, again, more and more African countries turning that way from the viewpoint of the United States.
Well, let's be honest. China does a very good job of engaging with African leaders. Already, you know, even before the summit formally opens, leaders from South Africa, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and even smaller countries like Mali and Djibouti have already had bilateral meetings with President Xi Jinping. We think back just 2 years ago to the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit, and President Biden didn't have any bilaterals. He had some small group meetings, but didn't have bilaterals. So the level of engagement is very high. So there's a lot to be said for Chinese engagement. On the other hand, for African countries that are in need of development finance, the reality is coming out of the pandemic with a slower recovery than anticipated, China's not in a position to do the same things that it did, you know, just a few years ago.
Is this something that you think the United States should be concerned about?
Well, I think we should always be concerned whenever a country that is a near peer competitor makes inroads anywhere in the world, and certainly someplace as strategic as Africa, with not only the critical mineral resources there, but the human capital. You know, the fact that in a few short years, one in four working age persons on the planet is going to be an African. So we should pay attention to China's inroads there. But at the same time, I think an opportunity exists for the United States precisely because China is unable to finance the projects that it has in the past. Lending is way down. It's half of what it was just a few years ago. And that's not even counting inflation. So the real value is even worth even less. And then also the fact that the heavy indebtedness of many African countries to China has led them to reevaluate the partnership.
That's J. Peter Pham, a former U.S. Special Envoy for the Great Lakes and the Sahel region. He was speaking with my colleague James Batty. Over 4,000 people globally die from cholera. That's according to the World Health Organization, which says there was an increase in cases and deaths in 2023. WHO Director General Tedros Ghebreyesus says the global cholera crisis is continuing, with 22 countries now reporting active outbreaks. Maureen Ojiambo reports from Sacramento.
Data from the World Health Organization indicates that the number of reported cholera cases increased by 13%, while deaths by 71% in 2023 compared to 2022. Countries like Afghanistan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Malawi, and Somalia are still reporting the largest number of outbreaks of over 10,000 suspected and confirmed cases. Other countries with the highest number of cholera cases in 2023 are Ethiopia, Haiti, Mozambique, and Zimbabwe. Speaking virtually during a media briefing on the global health issues, WHO Director General Tedros Ghebreyesus said, despite the lower number of cholera cases in 2024, there have been at least 342,800 cases and 2,400 cholera deaths reported to WHO across the world as of August 22nd.
Cholera kills 4,000 people a year, a disease that's preventable and easily treatable. Conflict, climate change, unsafe water and sanitation, poverty and displacement all contributed to the rise in cholera outbreaks last year. The geographical distribution of cholera also changed significantly, with cases from the Middle East and Asia declining by one-third and cases from Africa more than doubling.
The WHO report indicates that children under the age of 5 accounted for 38% of cholera cases globally. Ghebreyesus says, as a way of addressing vaccine shortages, the International Coordination Group, which manages emergency vaccine supplies, has since October 2022 suspended the standard cholera two-dose vaccination routine and adopted a single dose to reach more people.
The global cholera crisis has caused a serious severe shortage of cholera vaccines. Between 2021 and 2023, more doses were requested for outbreak response than the entire previous decade. About 36 million doses were produced last year, only half the amount requested by 14 affected countries.
There was a 125% increase in cholera cases in Africa, with many countries reporting a high number of community deaths, an indication that there are gaps in access to treatment on the continent. Felipe Barbosa is the technical team lead of the cholera program at the World Health Organization.
In Africa, the surveillance system and the way that the country are reporting cases is, I would say, much more similar with one another. And in addition, there are a number of countries that should be praised for doing that, that are also reporting the cases and the deaths.
The WHO considers the global risk from cholera as very high and is responding with urgency to reduce deaths and contain outbreaks around the world. This is the first year that multiple countries have reported deaths from cholera, which occurred outside of health facilities known as community deaths. In 5 out of 13 reporting countries, over a third of cholera deaths occurred in the community. The WHO says its appeal for $50 million to respond to cholera outbreaks this year remains unmet. For VOA Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in San Francisco.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, a new report says young women in sub-Saharan Africa face a lot of abuses. Find out why after the break. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. One in 4 young women aged between 20 and 24 years in sub-Saharan Africa have been physically, sexually, or psychologically abused by a partner. This is according to the World Health Organization. Now, a regional campaign supported by the UN Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization to create awareness about gender-based violence at universities is gaining momentum. Robin Chama reports for VOA from Nairobi.
Launched in March this year, the campaign dubbed Safer Campuses seeks to end violence against women in higher education institutions in East and Southern Africa. Remy Shawa is a senior program officer at UNESCO's regional office for Southern Africa.
Now that we have high incidences of gender-based violence and other forms of violence among students in higher education and tertiary institutions. In fact, one in 4 young women aged 20 to 24 years old in sub-Saharan Africa have been physically, sexually, or psychologically abused by a partner.
The campaign has been running in 6 African countries, including Zambia, Zimbabwe, Kenya, Tanzania, Namibia, and Uganda. Tinashe Chitunhu works with a non-governmental organization in Zimbabwe called Musasa that focuses on ending violence against women in the Southern African country.
In regards to violence against students at tertiary institutions, the trends that we have noted is that girls and boys at varsity experience similar forms of violence, which include psychological abuse. Other students can comment on a student's appearance. It can be sexually or meant to discredit ones in a sexual manner or even in a suggestive manner.
The initiative aims to shatter the silence surrounding violence against women and girls on campuses across East and Southern Africa. Young women in East and Southern Africa are particularly vulnerable to gender-based violence, often having experienced one or multiple incidents before reaching higher education institutions. Alberta Wambua is the executive director of Gender Violence Recovery Center, a Kenyan-based charitable trust providing free comprehensive medical treatment to survivors of sexual and gender-based violence.
From April 2023 to March 2024, the center provided medical treatment and psychosocial support and access to justice to 3,749 survivors of gender-based violence. In that same period, we had 228 survivors of gender-based violence from higher education institutes of learning.
This occurs within a global context where one in three women has encountered sexual or physical abuse at least once in their lifetime. UNESCO says the campaign will use various elements and channels to encourage students to break the silence and take action against all forms of gender-based violence. Remy Shawa explains.
But despite all these high numbers, we know that there could be more as reporting is low. Cultural and societal behavioral norms can make gender-based violence to be acceptable or endorsed or tolerated, and it can make it difficult for survivors to report and to seek justice. And additionally, there is that stigma that comes with gender-based violence.
The Safer Campuses campaign aims at engaging all tertiary education players, including government ministries, administrators, parents, and students, to act and work towards ending all forms of violence against women and girls by breaking the silence on this disturbing issue. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
From Nairobi, we'll move to the United States, where the U.S. government on Wednesday dismissed concerns that criminal charges brought against Hamas leaders in connection with the October 7 attack in Israel would complicate ongoing negotiations to reach a Gaza ceasefire deal in return for the release of hostages held by Hamas. VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Widakwaswara has this report.
Palestinian casualties as Israel hunts down Hamas. On Wednesday, Israel's military said 200 Hamas fighters in the southern Gaza city of Rafah had been killed. A day earlier, six Hamas leaders were indicted in connection to the October 7 attack in Israel by the U.S. Department of Justice. U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland.
For financing and directing a decades-long campaign to murder American citizens and endanger the security of the United States.
Three of the indicted Hamas leaders, Ismail Haniyeh, Marwan Issa, and Mohammed Deif, are believed to have been killed by Israel. The three remaining include the group's top leader, Yahya Sinwar, who is key to ongoing negotiations for a ceasefire in return for a hostage release agreement. As demonstrations continue in Israel demanding a deal, the Biden administration dismissed concerns that the indictment would complicate reaching one. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller.
We don't believe in any way the unsealing of this indictment is something that's going to enter into the calculations that Hamas may be making about whether to accept a ceasefire or not.
The U.S. charges were brought in February but unsealed Tuesday, days after Hamas had killed six hostages as Israeli forces closed in, including an American citizen, Hirsch Goldberg Polin. The charges are largely symbolic, since a U.S. arrest of Sinwar and the others is unlikely. But further U.S. action is possible. William Banks, an emeritus professor at Syracuse University College of Law, via Skype.
They can put pressure on our allies to try to secure any Hamas personnel who happen to be in an area where they can be detained. If not arrested. And I think that that threat over the longer term will continue to facilitate more peaceful efforts to come to settlements in the Middle East.
The U.S. indictment also accuses Iran and Lebanon's Hezbollah of providing financial support and weapons for the October 7 attacks. Patsy Widakwaswara, VOA News, Washington.
Still in U.S., Ukraine faces different prospects under a potential Donald Trump or Kamala Harris U.S. presidency. But as their campaigns race to the finish line, neither candidate has laid out exactly how they plan to deal with Russia's war on Ukraine. Experts say in the same space of time, the battlefield in Ukraine has itself radically changed, giving more power to Ukraine in determining its own fate. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell reports from Washington.
Ukraine's ancient capital knows well what it's like to be tossed about by the waves and whims of powerful forces. And so analysts there seem ambivalent to a possible second term for former President Donald Trump. Alexei Melnik is with the Foreign Relations and International Security Program at the Razumkov Think Tank.
Yes,
There is a prevailing opinion that the return of Trump to the White House is not the best scenario for Ukraine, although there are also cautious opinions that everything may not be that bad.
Trump has said he will swiftly end the war, though his running mate, J.D. Vance, once said he doesn't really care about Ukraine, leaving Ukrainians unsure what to think. This makes a potential Kamala Harris presidency more of a wild card to this nation that knows Trump and President Joe Biden so well. Harris has met with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and represented Biden at major transatlantic security summits. But on the trail, Harris has only briefly spotlighted Ukraine and how she differs from Trump.
He encouraged Putin to invade our allies, said Russia could, quote, do whatever the hell they want. 5 days before Russia attacked Ukraine, I met with President Zelensky to warn him about Russia's plan to invade. I helped mobilize a global response, over 50 countries, to defend against Putin's aggression. And as president, I will stand strong with Ukraine and our NATO allies.
Analysts say Harris is likely to follow Biden's support Ukraine playbook. And Trump's broad foreign policy pronouncements remain as vague as ever. Take Trump's promise that he will end the war in one day. Andrew Payne is a lecturer in foreign policy and security at City St. George's, University of London.
It's not entirely clear how he'll do that. The fear, of course, is that he'll do it by simply abandoning Ukraine, cutting off funds and pressuring Zelensky into negotiations at a time when Putin would enjoy all of the bargaining leverage.
But he says the battlefield has shifted with Ukrainian forces' recent decision to strike across the border and take a bite of Russian territory. While analysts widely predict that Ukraine will neither seek nor succeed in holding this land, it's a bargaining chip that will help Kyiv whoever wins. And he said Biden could also put his hand on the scale at a pivotal stage.
I wouldn't be expecting any shift in the U.S. position vis-a-vis Ukraine's military operations before November. But I would be watching between November and January, whatever the outcome, to see if there is a little bit more leash given to Kyiv.
And he notes Ukraine's leader has bolstered his relationships with European leaders and broadened his support. And so, as these two race to the end of this story, what could end up happening in Ukraine ultimately may not be up to the American president, whoever she or he is. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
And from politics to sports, the people of Sudan have a reason to smile. Sudan beat Niger 1-0 during the 2025 Africa Cup of Nations qualifying match on Wednesday. Sudan hosted Niger in Juba, and a 51st-minute goal from Thailand-based Abo Issa secured maximum Group F points. Comoros could not play at home because there is no international standard stadium in the country. They hosted Gambia in the Moroccan Atlantic city of El Jadida and broke the Group A deadlock on 37 minutes through Yusuf Muchagama. The Saudi Pro League midfielder Musa Barawu leveled first half at a time for Gambians, and there were no further goals. The Group D opener between Libya and Rwanda in Tripoli also finished 1-1 with Sophie Aldawi scoring after 17 minutes and Innocent Sully equalizing 2 minutes into the second half. Ethiopia did not manage one shot on target as they drew 0-0 with Tanzania in Group H in Dar es Salaam. And that's all we had for you on our menu for this Thursday, September 5th, 2024. We now leave you with the song Nambi by Sauti Sol. For more on our programs, visit www.voaafrica.com. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Bill Bass, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us tomorrow again for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Ulanjire, ulanjire, uere akaba, wahurile, wahurile.